Hello, and welcome back to these conversations and Zen Embodiment Bare Bones conversation with myself, Corey Hess. And today we have Bob Schrey on. Bob has been a mentor of mine for several years here. Bob is a former Zen teacher, a rolfer. He built his own off-grid awesome house in New Mexico. He's a painter, and he and his wife, Donna, developed something called Source Point Therapy. And I'm very pleased to have him here today. Welcome, Bob.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, great. I would like to, if we can, start to begin just to talk a little bit about your time with Kapila Roshi at the Rochester Zen Center. And just talk a little bit about that, and then I want to talk about how that led to some other things, if possible.
Okay. I was just looking today. I looked it up, and, the Three Pillars of Zen was published in 65 or 66. And at the time that Three Pillars of Zen was published, there was actually very little written about true Zen practice, what Zen practice. At that point, what you mostly had were D.T. Suzuki, which is a more philosophical approach, and people like Alan Watts, who really weren't Zen students. You had a few of, Gary Snyder and Walter Nowak, who had gone to Japan, and were writing a little bit about it. But there was very little available at the time. And I remember a few years later when the Daibozatsu Zendo was being dedicated with Edo Shimada.
Yeah.
And they had a large gathering of all the current Zen teachers in America and their, students that they wanted to bring. And we had a little gathering. And I remember several of the people of my generation who were students of Maizumi Roshi and different other teachers all talked about the influence that Three Pillars of Zen had had on them. And that's how many of them had ended up in the Zen world, even though it wasn't with Philip Kaplow. They had ended up, with people who were associated with Maizumi Roshi or Yasutani Roshi or Soen Roshi, all of those early things. So when I, after having read the Three Pillars, there was really very little option for training. I was in San Francisco. I began sitting actually at the San Francisco Zen Center with Suzuki Roshi.
Really?
Back in the, 66, whenever that was.
Oh, wow.
I ended up actually at the Rochester Zen Center kind of by accident. At that point, I was a draft resister and I was living in Canada.
Toronto,
yeah. And I actually met Philip Kaplow in Toronto.
Whoa.
And I actually met his wife before I met him.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Delancey Kaplow lived in Ottawa. Oh. And I lived on a communal farm in Kildu, Ontario.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I found out. Maybe it was in the some reference in the book to her, because her enlightenment story is in that book, in the Three Pillars of Zen.
Whoa.
And so I went to Ottawa to meet Delancey.
Whoa.
And so I actually met her first.
Wow. Interesting.
Wow. Yeah, it is.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, what was Kaplow like? Then when you went to Rochester, what was that like? What was
Well, you know, at that point in time, you know, the center there was just beginning to be formed.
Yeah.
You know, they had the buildings, 5 Arnold Park, 7 Arnold Park. And, you know, at that point in time, a lot, I think this was true probably at many of the Zen centers.
Yeah.
There was a strong core of people who had been pretty much in the hippie generation.
Yeah.
And living on communes or and so on.
Yeah.
And a lot of them ended up, not a lot, but the ones, some of them ended up in Rochester, some of them ended up in San Francisco, some ended up in LA.
Yeah.
But it was kind of that generation of people for the most part, not entirely.
Yeah.
There was a group of people who, Harry Gratwick, a couple of other people in Rochester who were older women who had read his book and invited him to come to Rochester.
Yeah.
And so there was a small group of, you know, what to us at that point seemed like older people. They're probably not as anywhere near as old as I am now, but they're probably in their 50s, right? Which seems ancient.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, the center there was set up, they had a staff program where you could be on full time, so you could work at the, actually live and work at the Zen Center.
Okay.
There was another building across the street for residents for staff.
Yeah.
And it was also a time of great unrest. I mean, not unlike today.
Yeah.
You know, you had, you know, the Black Panther movement. You had AIM, American Indian Movement. You had SDS, Student for Democratic Society. So there was that kind of atmosphere of intensity.
Yeah, wow.
And I think the Zen practice, the intensity of Zen practice matched the intensity of what was going on at the time.
Yeah, wow.
That's kind of how I ended up there. I had first read Three Pillars sitting in a corn crib in a communal farm in Eureka, Missouri. And, you know, from there I had, you know, became a, you know, draft resistor and gone to Canada and Toronto.
Yeah.
And, but I kept that book with me and it was just turned up quite by accident that the Rochester Zen Center was close to Toronto.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So it was, you know, an easy commute back and forth there. And
yes.
And you know, I was mostly involved with the Zen Center in Toronto. There was a small group of people in Toronto.
Yeah.
And then when the draft, the whole the amnesty program came in, I came back to the States.
Yeah, right.
Went directly on to staff.
Yeah.
So I was on staff.
And you were there like 15 years.
Yeah, we were there. Don and I were both there for a full 15 years.
Yeah, that's a long time. And,
a long time.
You got to be kind of like at a teacher level.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's a, in those photographs I sent you, there was a photograph of two people.
Okay.
There was and one of them is myself. We're both in brown robes. Right. And the other person in that photograph was a Dharma brother named Zenson.
Okay.
And Zenson and I became fairly quickly the main people that ran Sashin.
Yeah.
You know, played jikijitsu, you know, pretty much were Roshi's right-hand men, so to speak.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was a unique time. And
Okay, And then after 15 years, you were going out to Santa Fe and you were living in Santa Fe, and somehow you transitioned to leaving Zen and ended up training as a rolfer. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it probably wasn't quite as simple as you make it sound. It was actually a very, very complex affair. Basically, we had moved to Santa Fe specifically to start a Zen center, which was the Mountain Cloud Zen Center, which is still functioning here in Santa Fe. We had a number of difficulties when we came here, buying different property and having neighbors object and having to get that property up and then go someplace else. Yeah. So it actually was the third piece of property before things started to get worked out a little bit. And during that time, it was all the lawsuits, all of the legal things was just a huge amount of stress on the community and on Philip Kaplow and just everybody. And, I would say that stress led to some difficult interpersonal relationships. And I think it just became, and so the first step is I actually, Donna and our son Josh and I actually left and went to India for a year. We went to Sri Lanka and India and Nepal and Japan. Spent some time with Harada Roshi and Obama. And at that point, I was actually seriously considering Tangan Roshi had asked me to consider ordaining under him and staying in Japan. And, doing the Zen, English teacher trip that everybody did. And I had pretty much decided that that's what I wanted to do at that point. And then I got a phone call one morning and Philip Kaplow called me up and asked me to come back and take over the Zen Center in Denver and the Zen Center here. At the time, I kind of, I probably knew that I probably shouldn't do that. But I felt I felt obligated and, you know, I had, responsibilities and commitments. And I said, I kind of took a deep breath and said, okay, I'll come back. And then once I came back, it was just clear that things were not working out. Part of it was due to my perspectives had broadened a lot. Being in India and Sri Lanka, and I did a long Vipassana retreat in Sri Lanka. So, you know, my interest was becoming a little broader than just the kind of narrow Zen part of Buddhism. So anyway, so all of those things kind of came together. It was clear, I think both to Philip Kaplow and to myself, it was time to go. And I mean, I'm simplifying these tremendously, but I think you get the gist. There are Zen politics or it's just any place else, right?
You know, so difficult transition, I'm sure. And maybe if we have time, we'll backtrack to Tangan Roshi, I would like to hear about. But what about, so what about going on and what was it like to train as a, why did you go and train as a rolfer?
Well, I went to train as a rolfer for probably not any profound reason. There were some things that I'd been interested in rolfing before I went to Canada. At that point, Dr. Rolf was at Esalen Institute.
Yes.
And, I had actually was thinking of going to Esalen.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a, I've been thinking of going there, but because of my draft situation, I thought, okay, I have to get out of there. The interesting thing was is that when I left this country, I ended up meeting a group of people in Toronto who had been a major part of this publication in San Francisco, the Whole Earth catalog.
Right, cool.
And some of them had had to leave the country also for the same reason. And we all met at Rochdale College in Toronto.
Wow.
And so I got involved with that.
Yeah.
And the person who was kind of in charge of that asked me if I would edit an issue on healing.
Right.
And through that job, I got to know more about rolfing. I got to interview a lot of osteopaths and chiropractors and radiologic practitioners. So I had a, interest in healing in general long before I came to the Zen Center.
Yes. Yes.
And, when I left, the Zen Center, that was kind of my orientation. I thought, okay, maybe I should go to naturopathic school. Maybe I should become a chiropractor. Maybe I should go become an osteopath.
Right.
And quite honestly, the decisions out of all those choices were circumstance. One is we had a son who was in his early teens, 10. At that point, he was probably 12. No, at that point, he was 13.
Yeah.
And so there was an issue of, how do I support family? And, I kind of, because of my background in architecture, I kind of gravitated towards doing construction work.
Right.
Immediately, because I knew, had several friends, old Zen friends that ran construction businesses.
Right.
So I worked with them for a while. And in terms of trying to figure out what to do from then on, this is actually how a lot of things happened for me. Two things happened. One is there was Jan Sultan.
Yes.
Lived in Santa Fe.
Okay.
His kids and our son were in the same school.
Oh, really?
So I knew Jan as a parent, and we used to take kids hiking.
Okay.
So I knew Jan outside the rolfing community.
Yes, yes.
And he was in the process of doing, I think, the last advanced class that he taught here in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
And we offered to host somebody who was in that training. And we were sitting at a breakfast table one morning, and he looked at my hands and said, "You should be a rolfer."
Bob's got huge hands. Look at Bob. They're huge.
So that was kind of it. It's like I didn't, I certainly had an affinity for healing and wanted to go in that direction. But what opened up was that suggestion. And then Jan said, "Oh, if you want to, get in, I'm going to teach one more basic class."
Yeah.
In this next spring, he said, "I can help you."
Yeah.
Work towards that if you want.
Right.
And so Jan was a big piece here for me.
Yes.
And so yeah, and I kind of just went with the flow of things. I've kind of never, I don't know, I think it's just good karma. I've never really like struggled with, okay, how do I manifest this?
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, what's next?
Yes.
And I kind of just rolled with it. I mean, the kind of situation of leaving the Zen Center for many people would have been traumatic, or, well, it was traumatic.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know where to go after they've spent that much time.
Yes.
Involved.
Yes.
And for me, it was just like, I didn't spend much time trying to figure anything out.
Right. Right.
It was like, okay, construction job.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, make some money.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, rolfing. Yes.
I'll take it.
Yeah, right. I'll take it. Right. Yeah, exactly. And plus, it turned out it wasn't quite that simple, but yeah. You know, the gist of it was, and also the other, a major factor for me, time was a very practical one.
Yeah.
It's like compared to chiropractic school or osteopathy. Which were the two other things I was thinking about.
Yeah.
They would have required moving and also, a number of years, quite a few years.
Yes, right.
You know, the structural integration training, as you know, can be done in about 2 years.
Yep.
So it's that was another piece for me.
Yep.
Me
too.
Yeah. Kind of look around and take your options.
Yeah. Can you say a little bit about how your Zen training helped you to refine and explore touch, presence and touch? I would love to hear a little bit about that. I think that would be really interesting for people. How does the experience of all that, you know, meditation and all that, how did that inform your touch, if you can?
Well, I would say at that point, I really wasn't thinking that much about touch. You know, at that point, the notion of gentle rolfing was not in the picture.
Right.
You know, pretty much old style rolfing was being taught by almost everybody at that point.
Yes.
You know, Peter Melchior may have had a more gentle touch, but, Stacy Mills, a few other people, but for the most part, it was a real more aggressive type of touch.
Yes, yes.
Which, you know, ironically was kind of in line with having been in jiu-jitsu for 15 years, you know. And I didn't realize at the time, I mean, once I started rolfing, I had a number of clients who had sessions by all kinds of other people, and they said, "You're not doing the same thing that anybody else is doing at all."
Okay.
And I would go like, "Well, what do you mean?" And they could never really articulate it.
Yep.
But I think this is what you've been pointing to in your podcast, is that there is a whole way of, from the Zen perspective and the working from the Dandian or Hara,
yep,
that, you know, you use what touch is appropriate to make the contact that needs to be made.
Yes.
So from the very beginning, you know, I was never wedded to a particular type of touch.
Yes, yes, yes.
What was needed.
Right.
Well, I'll have to admit, in the beginning, I was probably pretty heavy-handed.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so the, you know, part of what I love about Bob and Donna are that they seem to have integrated a lot of this into their lives, and they a lot of people who go and do training, they do kind of struggle with learning how to communicate that in the world. And one thing that drew me to both of them is this: they seem to have found a way to express that and to bring that into life. But I think, you know, Bob, you also went and studied a lot of things after that. You had a lot of other experiences that informed your life, which So I'd like to hear a little bit about that, other teachers, other experiences, other, you know, trainings or whatever that helped you to eventually develop SourcePoint.
Yeah, so my very first training was with when I was still at the Zen Center in Rochester. And I did a polarity therapy training with Pierre Panettiere.
Right.
Pierre was one of Dr. Stone's first major teachers.
Okay.
He was really close to Dr. Stone.
Yes.
And so I had a background in energy work. And also at that time, while I was at the Zen Center in Rochester, there was a man there who introduced me. He had lived in London during the early Scientology days.
Whoa.
And had met this man named Malcolm Ray.
Yeah.
Malcolm Ray was a radionics practitioner.
Right.
In London. And so I had been introduced to the whole field of radionics, which is also an energetic medicine.
Yes.
So I had a real interest in energetic medicine. I decided not to go in that direction when I became a Rolfer, just because I wanted something that was more physical.
Yep. Yep.
And down to earth.
Yep.
And even though I did study homeopathy and other things. Yeah. So after leaving the Zen Center, I kind of just migrated back towards, you know, all those interests I had in healing.
Yes.
And, you know, at that point in time, Rolfing was not so oriented towards manual therapy and biomechanics.
Here we go. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, Tom Wing, who's one of my teachers, said, oh, yeah, the best Rolfers are people who have a background in the crafts and the arts.
Right.
Not in science and massage and so on.
Right.
So it was a really different atmosphere when, and it was really common for at that point in time for people to talk to work with their clients with their dreams.
Right.
Or, you know, with journals. You know, a more, what I would say, holistic approach.
Yes.
And so after being at the Rolf Institute, I realized right away that I needed more training in order to be able to work with people effectively.
Yes.
And I also realized that Donna and I had both been doing a lot of reading and studying about trance phenomena.
Yeah.
And cult phenomena.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And all of those things interface with each other. And I realized fairly quickly that when you're working with someone, you're working with all of them. You're working with their unconscious as well as their conscious mind.
Yes.
You know, Jung said the body is the unconscious.
Yes.
So I felt like I needed to understand trance phenomena better. So I spent a few years studying Ericksonian hypnotherapy.
Right, right.
A man named Robert Weiss here who had studied with Milton Erickson. And because he had studied with Milton Erickson, he brought a lot of other people here to Santa Fe that had been Milton Erickson's main students.
Okay.
So I studied, you know, basically medical hypnosis.
Right.
And that was really my next next main thing I focused on.
Right.
And that was really, I think, really eye-opening in the sense that I think it really opened my it opened the doorway, I think, into the whole kind of shamanic realm.
Right, right.
And also simultaneous with that, because it was some of the same people.
Yeah.
I ended up being good friends with Rick Strassman, who wrote DMT, The Spirit Molecule.
Right, Right.
He was doing this research at UNM
right.
Hospital at that point. And, you know, through them, I met Ralph Metzner. Right. Wow. I studied with Ralph for 10 years.
Wow.
Doing group session work.
Yep.
And started studying cranial sacral therapy
right.
with various people.
Right.
I shared an office with a British osteopath for 4 years.
Oh, really?
So, I learned a lot from him.
Yeah.
So just kind of expanded into all those fields. And the one thing that tied all of these things together for me, from the polarity therapy to the radionics to other forms of energy work, to Rolfing, was this notion of a blueprint.
Right.
You know, Dr. Rolf said in her book, you know, there was a platonic blueprint.
Yes.
And that kind of gets overlooked these days, but that was a big part of her thinking.
Right.
And, she said in her initial book, she said, perhaps there is an energetic pattern that is untouched by the vicissitudes of life, by trauma.
Right.
And that all we're doing is Rolfers, perhaps, she said, perhaps, all we're doing as Rolfers is organizing a body around that pre-existing pattern.
Right, right.
So, and then this notion of a blueprint is also foundational to biodynamic work.
Right.
That's there in the osteopathic field, it's there in the radionics field.
Right.
It's there in the shamanic world.
Right.
So I also, through Rick Strassman and Ralph Metzner, I ended up doing a lot of psychedelic work, shamanic work, and going to Brazil and,
right.
Being on that path for quite some time. And so all of those things contributed to what eventually became Source Point.
I wrote a paper about this a couple years ago, and of Source Point therapy, and what I was discovering was, and we talked about this, is that the shaman originally was, you know, they weren't just a healer, they were a musician, they were an artist, right? They were a healer, all of these things. So it, at one point, you know, this idea of healing was not just this one thing. It was about a context, right?
Yeah.
And Bob, trained as an architect and a painter, so I think bringing all that also to the table was this different view of what, you know, organizing around this blueprint would be in healing. So, So that started to become something which later became Source Point.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And that was a long process, right?
Yes, it was. It was a long process. It wasn't overnight. It wasn't like, decades and decades.
Right.
But it was a long, long process.
Yeah.
And, in my work as a painter was just as much a part of that as anything else.
Right.
What really kind of brought things together for me, all these different threads together, actually, is I was in Zurich and 19, I don't know, remember what the, I think it might have been 80, it was after probably, I don't know when, late 80s, I think there was a main show, big show at the Kunsthaus in Zurich,
right.
Of Emma Kunz, the right. Swiss artist Emma Kunz, Rudolf Steiner's blackboard drawings,
right,
and Joseph Beuys.
Right.
So all of these people were involved with healing and as artist.
Yes.
you know, they were all artists.
Yes.
And Hilma af Klint would be in that category also.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, it's really interesting if you know, Hilma af Klint, there was a big show at the Guggenheim last year for work.
Right.
And it was the most well-attended show of the whole history of the Guggenheim Museum.
Right, right.
And, you know, she was probably one of the first abstract artists, because arguably the first.
Right.
She knew Kandinsky.
Wow.
She was in that, and clay and all that early part. But her paintings were paintings that were completely channeled.
Right.
And so her paintings were designed to take people to this other dimension.
Right.
And she even did a drawing of how she wanted them exhibited.
Right.
The spiraling building.
Wow.
Which eventually turned out to be the Guggenheim Museum.
Right. Wow.
But, you know, that's like how many years later, 100 years later?
Right. Right. Wow. Wow.
So these are the kind of people that really influenced me.
Yes. Yes.
And, Emma Kuntz was similar. She said she healed through her art.
Right. People would go into the room with the art, right?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, she. Yeah, Emma Kuntz would do, people would come to her for healing, and she would lock herself in a room for 24 or 48 hours and do these remarkable drawings. And those drawings were part of the healing process and for people that she was working with.
Yes.
As well as a way for her to understand more what was going on.
Yes, yes.
We were both diagnostic and healing.
Right, right. Yeah. When people take the source point therapy mod one, there's a whole presentation to it. You go in and there's this, it's a little bit long, it's like an hour or something, and you're just sort of download all this stuff, and it's just kind of all the connections that Bob and Donna have made it's pretty shocking to, you know, to see, all these things are related. All of these different traditions throughout history have all been sort of related in a way that it's amazing how you put that presentation together and talk about that. But I think, you know, this notion of what is healing throughout all these traditions is very interesting. And can you talk about that and then talk about what source point is? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, so to kind of continue on from this Hilma af Klint, because it relates to this, I mentioned that all of her paintings were literally channeled.
Yes.
She did these paintings she said, I have a commission.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, Bob and Donna, and
yes,
most of the source point work was also channeled. Donna is a very skilled, intuitive, and channel.
Yeah.
And so the bulk of the source point material, even though there are all these other things that fed into it,
right,
the actual material within the workshops come from that channeled sessions that I did with Donna.
Right, right.
From all my, psychedelic work with Ralph and with other people, you know that when you're dealing with these other realms that your experiences are shaped by the questions that you bring.
Right.
So the information that was coming through was very much being shaped by the questions that I had, my background, Donna's background, and so on.
Yes.
So it didn't, it wasn't like I sat down and tried to figure source point out.
Right.
Source point was basically given to Donna and myself.
Right, right.
And it was our responsibility to codify it, put it in order. The three workshops are pretty much in the order that the material came through.
Right.
So there's no, we're not trying to hide that fact. In fact, what I've seen is there have been so many difficulties, like say for within the structural integration world, where there are people who say that the Rolfing work was channel information.
Right.
And, you know, the attempts to minimize that and hide it and make it fit in the scientific worldview.
Right.
Leads to a lot of really messy energetics in the community, which I think are still there.
Yeah.
Wow. Not just at the Rolf Institute, but in the whole structural integration community.
Right. Can you talk about what you do in a source point session in, you know, in a few minutes, what that's like? I think that would be really helpful for people to kind of get a sense of what it is.
Yeah. So source point, first of all, is just a name.
You're right.
But it's, in many ways, source point is identical in my mind to the stated goals and principles of structural integration.
Right.
So while we're working with the basic premise of source point is that there is an energetic blueprint for the health of the human being.
Right.
And this is not a new notion.
Right.
You know, there have been books called The Pattern of Health. You know, a lot of traditional cultures talk about pattern of health.
Yes.
Relationship between pattern and health.
Yes.
And so none of those are new ideas. So, but the thing that is different is that what came through is that this pattern of health or blueprint can be accessed through points in the field around the body.
Right, right.
So those points around the body are what part of what was brought through.
Yes.
And there are points that have the specific function of connecting to that blueprint of health, different aspects of that blueprint of health.
Yes, yes, yes.
And another assumption there is that, which is also there in Dr. Rolf's teaching, and it's there in the biodynamic teaching and the osteopathic teaching, is that this, what we're calling the blueprint, is sentient.
Right.
And that it has its own intelligence. It knows where to go in the body and knows what to do.
Right.
And so in that sense, as a practitioner, we're simply there to help it do its work.
Right.
And that blueprint knows you personally as a therapist.
Yes.
So a session that you do will look different than a session that I do.
Right.
Right. Because you have different skill sets.
Right.
And so you'll be bringing those skill sets present in a session also. So, so what a source point session looks like depends, A, on the person doing it, and even more so, it depends on what's needed by the person you're working with.
Right, right, right.
Because the next question, the obvious question is, okay, if there is a blueprint of health, what's keeping it from manifesting?
Right, right.
And so in the source point work, we learn to scan the body with our hands. Yep. To find out where those blockages are that are keeping that from blossoming, from that flowing.
Right.
And in that sense, it's a very, in some sense, a Reiki approach.
Right.
You know, working with the blockages that are keeping the organ energy or vital life force from manifesting.
Right.
The difference is that in the source point work, we don't have a protocol in the sense of you do this first, you do this session first, this session next.
Right.
There's not a concept of how that unfolds.
Right.
How that unfolds is done, determined entirely with your scanning.
Right. Right. Right.
So with the scanning, we're looking at where's the primary blockage that's obstructing the flow of information in the blueprint.
Right. And so the definition of health would be then
the free flow of that information in the blueprint.
Right. Right. And where health is not happening is there's a blockage there to that information.
Yeah. Well, the blockage may or may not be where the problem is.
Right.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that we learn as structural integrators.
Right.
You know, go where it's not.
Right, right, right.
You know, so, and the same is true of a blockage. Just because somebody has a bad neck doesn't mean the blockage is in the neck. Probably not.
Right, right, right.
Mostly not.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So, and what I look at, the way that I look at it is that every discipline, whether it's structural integration or acupuncture,
yes,
or osteopathy or modern medicine,
yes,
everything, everybody has indicators that they've done a good session.
Yes.
You know, so an acupuncturist goes like, oh, your pulses are balanced
right
now, or you've got Shen in your eyes, right?
Right.
Those are really common. So from my point of view is that if you're working directly from the perspective of the blueprint,
yeah,
ideally all of those things show up.
Right. Right.
Which is why you can use the structural integration, I mean the source point approach,
right,
to do non-formulaic and advanced structural work.
Right. Right. Right.
And the other thing I think that people have seen is that energy precedes structure.
Right, right.
So, and this is where it got to be a little challenging for people, because when we did classes together, they would see these remarkable structural changes.
Right.
That were only supposed to be happening if you did a 10 series.
Right. Right, right.
But they would be there after one session or two sessions.
Yes, yes.
So I'm still, at source point, I'm still using those indicators for health.
Yes, yes.
That everybody uses. So good movement pattern.
Right, right, right.
Good alignment. All of those show up just as well from working from an energetic perspective is from a structural perspective.
Right, right, right. Well,
it makes your, if you're a structural integrator,
yeah,
it makes your work a lot easier.
Right, right. Yeah. I maybe we'll say a quick bit about the distance work. Seems to have been a nice thing to be able to do during this time, during the whole COVID-19 time. There's a distance work aspect to this, and I have personally found it very effective and shocking at times, and in some ways more straightforward than the in-person sessions. You know, I just, it's been really amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's a flip for a lot of people. A lot of people, you know, again, hands-on, simple, you know, okay, I'm doing this. But in a way I found, oh, this is doing this distance work, dealing just with the energetic blueprint is actually, there's less to work, less in the way, it's clearer. Okay, I'm working with this person.
Yeah, I think I agree with you completely. I think it can often be even more dramatic. You know, I'm just saying that, you know, it's quite remarkable sometimes what happens when you're working purely at the energetic
level. Right.
You know, and that brings up another question, this whole dialogue within this SI world of, you know, are we doing just fix it work? Are we doing a 10 series? Are we, do we have a bigger perspective? And we're not really interested in the details. Which is how some people think about it. Right. And from the source point perspective, you can do all of them.
Right.
You know, my basic assumption is that anything people come in with is a result of energy blockages that are keeping this blueprint from flowing through their body.
Yes. Right. Great. So
whether that's writer's block or a headache or a ski accident.
Right.
The same principle.
Right. And people will come for different reasons. They'll come, you know, I want to be more spiritual, or I have a knee problem, or
right.
I want to be more creative. Right.
Right. Yep.
Interesting. Let's close it up. So do you have anything more you'd like to add today? It's been really informative, I think, and I think helpful for people to get a sense of your journey here. What else would you like to say today?
Well, you know, for me, I was thinking about this. For me, my connection with art is really an important piece. And people used to always ask me, well, what do you do to build your practice as a rolfer?
Yeah.
You know, do you advertise? Do you do lectures? And I would always say that if my practice is slow, I just paint.
Yeah.
And then the phone call starts ringing. So, you know, I know, and that's another good thing about Joseph Beuys. Joseph Beuys was well known for saying that everybody is an artist.
Yes.
So just because you're not a painter or a musician or doesn't mean you don't have access to that creative energy.
Yes.
Everybody has access to it.
Right.
It's just, we all catch it differently.
Yes.
We all do different things with it.
Yes.
And, so to what I would say, you know, do what you can to stay in touch with that flow of creative energy. Keep it creative. It's not just a job.
Yeah. Yes.
It's not just a profession. It's a, you know, it's an art form.
Yeah.
And I found that really true in the last year and a half. You know, as you know, I've been going through dealing with a cancer diagnosis.
Yes.
And, you know, so, and now with this pandemic, you know, the drawing has been a really important part of my work currently.
Yes.
You know, until I'm able to start up my practice again and so on, which I haven't done yet here.
Right. I love it. So the shamanic work, you know, I just love it. It just, for us people who maybe aren't as open-minded, it's just really awesome to think about that. You know, again, this marriage of art and healing and music and all that, it's all one thing, you know.
Well, you know, one thing to think about might be a good note to close here.
Yeah.
You know, there's always been within the structural integration community this dialogue, how do we become better known? Why aren't we as well known as acupuncturists or chiropractors or so on?
Right.
At one point, and again, this was when Dr. Rolf was at Esalen, somebody asked her, what is Rolfing most similar to?
Right.
And she said, it's most similar to shamanism.
Right.
it's not more similar to osteopathy or chiropractic or physical therapy.
Yeah.
Shamanism is the thing that is closest to.
Yeah.
And what I, reason I'm mentioning this is that if we look back, you know, we're looking back, that was what, almost 50 years ago?
Yeah.
Shamanism has become very, very well known.
Right.
Structural integration has not.
Right, right.
And my own feeling is that if structural integration had really aligned itself
right.
with what it was most truly in alignment with,
yes,
it would be much more better known. And a lot of the alignments that were made were because the AMTA was formed.
Right.
The Rolf Institute decided they wanted to be an ally of the AMTA.
Right.
They also wanted to counteract, John Barnes's work, right. Myofascial release work for physical PTs. Right. So they got into this. I mean, Dr. Rolf actually said in that quote, another quote, "I don't want people to be crossing swords with PTs and osteopaths and right. so on." And we've kind of, as a profession, have gotten into crossing swords with all those people.
Yes, yes. Wow, wow.
And, you know, the ironic thing is that there's an oncologist here in town, and he feels that one of the most important pieces of energy work, I mean, of cancer treatment, is having people have some form of energy work yeah. on the team.
Yeah.
And when I went into my first infusion for the melanoma treatment, the oncology nurse asked me, "Oh, do you want to hold this and do energy work over it or Reiki yeah. before we put it up there?" And she said, "People do this all the time." So it's kind of ironical that yeah. things like, Reiki and healing touch, all of these other energetic shamanism, all these other energetic approaches are actually accepted in a, what do they call them? Not mixed practice, but this is the term.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I know what you mean. Right, right, yeah. right.
So because a lot of people have realized that in our current time,
yeah,
we need teams of people.
Yes, yes.
Rather than magic individuals.
Right, right, right.
And that's kind of how we've positioned the source point work.
Yeah.
It complements
right, right.
other work.
Right, right.
And, to have an oncologist send somebody to me is like,
yeah,
I don't know, an oncologist who's sending people for Rolfing.
Right, right.
Structural integration.
Right.
So my interest is, even though I still consider myself to be a Rolfer, a structural integrationist,
right.
my interest is in the overall healing field of healing.
I love it. Love it. Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. Perfect. Beautiful way to end. Thank you so much, Bob. It's so great to see you and hear your words today. Thanks for being here.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for asking me. And can I leave you with one last to tie it together with your Zen background?
Yeah.
You know, in the Zen, and this is only in the Zen tradition, it's said that the Buddha, upon his great awakening, said, "Wonder of wonders, all beings, just as they are whole and complete and lacking nothing, endowed with wisdom and foreknowledge." That's the blueprint.
Yeah, right. Right. That's the blueprint.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, the blueprint is not just about health, it's about our full potential that we have as a human being.
Right, right. Well, thank you so much, Bob. Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Bye. See you soon.
Okay, good. We'll talk soon.
Okay, good.